Good afternoon, everybody. Thank you all for coming. I'm Jeremy Hobson. I host Here and Now on WBUR and NPR, 12 to 2 every weekday. We're here at a very important time for a very important topic. I'm from the Midwest. I grew up in Urbana, Illinois. We remember that President Trump would not have won the presidency if he hadn't won states like Ohio, Indiana, Iowa, Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin. President Obama wouldn't have won the presidency if he hadn't won Ohio, Indiana, Iowa, Michigan, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin. So today we have four people who have been writing about the Midwest, and they can give us a better understanding of this very important part of our country just a month before the midterm elections. So let me introduce to you Austin Smith, who is the author of a book of poems called Flyover Country. He teaches at Stanford and grew up on a farm in northwestern Illinois. Ben Bradley Jr., who is the author of The Forgotten, How the People of One Pennsylvania County Elected Donald Trump and Changed America. He's a longtime Boston Globe reporter and editor. Sarah Kendzior is with us as well, who is the author of The View from Flyover Country. She's known for her reporting on St. Louis and coverage of the 2016 election and is an op-ed columnist for The Globe and Mail. And Jonathan Weiler, professor at the University of North Carolina and author of Prius or Pickup, How the Answers to Four Simple Questions Explain America's Great Divide. So before we get into our conversation, because we have a poet on stage, I'm going to ask Austin to read us a couple of poems from his book. Austin.
Thank you, Jeremy. And thank you to the Boston Book Festival for welcoming us. I'm going to read a few poems from my collection, Flyover Country. I called the book this phrase because I found it to be a very condescending phrase to describe the region of the country I love so much. And then also in my book, I write a bit about American foreign policy. So I think that that phrase resonates a little bit with the political as well. The first poem I'm going to read, called Cat Moving Kittens, is about how my brothers and I on the family dairy farm would go hunting for kittens in the haymow. Cat moving kittens. We must have known, even as we reached down to touch them, where we'd found them, shut-eyed and trembling, under a straw bale in the haymow, that she would move them that night under cover of darkness, and that by finding them, we were making certain we wouldn't see them again. Until we saw them, crouching under the pickup like sullen teens, having gone as wild by then as they'd gone, still in her mouth that night, she made a decision any mother might make upon guessing the intentions of the state. To go and to go now, taking everything you love between your teeth. Thanks. Thank you. And the second poem I'll read, and then I'll read two at the end of the panel, is called Country Things, and I wanted to write a little bit about how country life is maybe not so idyllic as we oftentimes think it is, and there's a lot of violence in the country. And so this poem kind of grapples with that. Country Things. Some days, even nature seems sinister. Walking around the farm with a beer, seeking some solace after the evening news, you meet the cat you love coming back from the windbreak, a rare songbird in his mouth. In the mulberry branches, the silkworms writhe in nests that, backlit by twilight, look like x-rays of lungs. In the pasture, the cow kicks at her calf and won't let her nurse, while in a seam of gleaming honey, in the oak that lightning cleaved, the queen daintily eats her offspring. In the rafters of the barn, the starlings are pushing the owl's eggs out of the nest while the owl herself is out hunting. Going in, you nearly step on a swarm of ants ravishing a butterfly like pirates tearing a capsized ship down, its wings like torn sails. And the first thing you hear when you enter the kitchen is the snap of the mouse trap you set this morning. tired of being kept awake all night by their scratching in the walls. And so you are met with your own small act of cruelty, your contribution to the whole, with a pair of pliers that are themselves always biting something. You take the broke-necked mouse by the tail and throw it into the darkening yard, never knowing that in favor of it, the cat let go of the bird, who was only stunned, and whose song you woke to this morning.
Thank you, Austin. I want to just tell everyone that we'll be taking your questions towards the end of this, and also that after we're done, all of these authors will be heading back there to sign some books. So let me start with you, Ben Bradley. Why did you want to write about this part of the country? You focused on a county in Pennsylvania near Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania. Why did you think it was important to do that?
Well, like more than half the country, I was shocked that a president as unusual as Donald Trump was elected and looking for... I'm not a technician, but I do. Just talk louder, I guess. Combing through the vote in the three most critical states, Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin, I discovered this one county in northeast Pennsylvania called Luzerne County, which turned out to be a critical county in a swing state. This is a traditionally Democratic county that hadn't voted for a Republican since Bush Sr. in 1988. Obama had carried it twice, but it surged in the other direction for Trump. And he piled up such a margin in this one county.
There we go.
Okay, a little better.
There we go.
I better not start from the top. I'll take everyone else's time. Anyway, I discovered this county, which turned out traditionally Democratic, but it surged for Trump by such a margin that it comprised 60% of his victory margin in Pennsylvania. So without this one county, he wouldn't have won that state or perhaps the presidency. So I went down and thought that this would be a useful prism into the Trump vote.
What about you, Sarah? Why did you want to write about the Midwest?
Well, I live in the Midwest. I think I need this too. I live in the Midwest. I live in St. Louis. So, you know, none of this is a hypothetical to me. None of this is kind of optional to me. This is just my life, and I cover national politics from the vantage point of St. Louis. This shouldn't be unusual. It is unusual nowadays. One out of every four national journalists lives in three very expensive cities on the coasts. I wasn't that surprised when Trump won, in part because my state, Missouri, did go for Trump. But I guess one thing I want to emphasize, just to sort of set the tone for this discussion, is that the Midwest is not a monolith, and you can't draw a conclusion from my experience in St. Louis, you know, to Missouri as a whole, to the Midwest as a whole, to other states. And so I hope the diversity within the Midwest is accounted for as we continue this discussion.
I'm always surprised when people confuse Illinois with Indiana or other states, which they do all the time. By the way, how are we going to get this all the way over to the other side? That's going to
be
tough.
Well, just pass it.
Ferry.
I'm always surprised when people confuse. I was going to say, Austin, you mentioned that the term flyover country was condescending. Your book also has the word flyover country. Did you do that? I mean, what did you...
Yeah, you know, it is a condescending phrase, and I inverted it. The title of my book is The View from Flyover Country, because we're often a region that's written about, but tends people who actually live there tend to lack a voice nationally. This is kind of a random thing. It's a collection of essays. The first essay was called that. The book ended up being called that. And I think that, you know, some folks who think this is some sort of, you know, positive explanation of Trump are for a real surprise if you pick up the book itself. Because it's pretty broad, but yeah, I'm tired of that term being used in the way that it has been as well.
Jonathan, now I've lost this, but there we go, it's back. Jonathan, tell us why you decided to write about the Midwest. You live in North Carolina.
Yeah, so just to...
Is it on?
Is this This is working. So our book, just to clarify, Prius or Pickup, is not specifically about the Midwest. It's really about the national political picture, but it tries to focus on two types of people who we call fixed and fluid, who see the world in fundamentally different terms. And I think one of the things that my co-author and I were really interested to look at and explore was the degree to which the fluid or liberal perspective on a whole range of issues, from race to immigration and so forth and so on, is actually in many ways the outlier perspective in the United States and not the sort of the mainstream perspective. And I think the more we looked at the data, we're wonky academics, so we spent a lot of time looking at data, but the more we looked at the data, I think what we found especially sobering was that folks in the middle, who we very cleverly called the mixed, on many issues were closer to the fixed in their view of race and immigration and so forth and so on than they were to the fluid. And that was something that we found particularly, again, from our perspective, sobering when we think about how somebody like Donald Trump could have been elected.
Why do you think that is?
So I would say the short answer to that question is that on many of those kinds of issues on race and immigration, a lot of folks' default mode, especially in times of just change and uncertainty, is to want to reach for the familiar. And to be sort of put off by or unnerved by the novel and the new. And we can get into this in the discussion. There are plenty of ways in which liberals in places like Boston and New York City, where I grew up, when under fearful circumstances, will themselves default to the familiar and the tried and the true. But I think those are in many ways a default mode for people in general in times of flux and change.
Austin, you are back in the Midwest now. You're living in Illinois again. You were at Stanford, but now you're back in Illinois. Why did you decide to write this book of poems about the Midwest, flyover country?
Right. Well, my first book of poems was called Almanac. It was very much focused upon my childhood on a family dairy farm in Illinois. I had a somewhat unusual upbringing in that my father is a poet, and I've spent probably more time in the last decade away from the Midwest than I have in the Midwest. So around the time of Trump's election, I was at Stanford. My friends didn't think it was possible he could win, but my dad and I had just driven to a Green Bay Packers game across the state of Wisconsin, and we had seen so many Trump signs, it was the week before the election, and I said, well, you know, the view from flyover country is a little different. So with this book, again, as I said before, I do find it a very condescending term. I find it very careless to characterize an entire region of a country this way. And I think that in these poems, I'm trying to bring a little bit more specificity and care to the region and to its people.
You know, we've just been traveling around the country for our show, and I met this guy in Indiana who was laid off from a factory, not Carrier, but Rexnord. It is another, you know, manufacturer that had moved jobs to Mexico. This guy voted for Obama twice, and then he voted for President Trump. And he did not. President Trump went on Twitter and attacked the CEO of the company that had moved these jobs to Mexico. It didn't actually stop the company from doing that, but he had at least called him out. And this guy said, you know, I lost my job, but I still think at least he was talking to me. I didn't hear anything from Hillary Clinton, and I didn't hear anything from President Obama about my factory, my particular factory, moving jobs away. So I thought that was interesting. I don't know what your thoughts on that, Ben. That you know, people at least feel in many of these places where the economy has not come back that President Trump is thinking about them.
They like him. They like his style. They like his feistiness. How he never apologizes, never backs down, how he gets up every morning and sends off a couple of Twitter rockets, how he sticks it to the elite every day. And Trump is not actually, my experience in Luzerne County is that while they like a lot of the things he's done, especially the tax cut and two Supreme Court justices now. He's not delivered for them on certain economic metrics. He hasn't fixed health care, which a lot of people voted for him because of, repeal and replace Obamacare. That hasn't happened. He said he was going to eliminate the deficit in 8 years, but his 2018 budget adds $7 trillion to the deficit. He said he was going to increase or hold the line on Medicaid and Medicare, but that's been cut, $500 billion each. So, but that doesn't seem to matter. It's more of an emotional connection, and they just like his style.
Sarah, what do you make of that? It sounds like your mic is good. Everybody's mic is good except for Ben's, so he can keep the hand
mine
up.
Is all right? You guys can hear me? Okay. Yeah. Well, I think we need to specify what kind of people we're talking about when we talk about folks in the Midwest who like Trump. We're talking about white people. We're mostly talking about white men. We're mostly talking about older white men. Economic problems plague the region as a whole. If there is some sort of equality that brings everything together, it is that. It is a sense of abandonment. It is a sense of economic despair. I think that that's felt widely across people from different backgrounds, different ethnicities, different races. Only one group voted overwhelmingly for Donald Trump, and that was white people, and in particular, white men. And since the election, yeah, I agree that he didn't deliver. He had no intention of deliver. He came in like a vulture, preying on people's pain, and he was able to do that somewhat effectively. He was able to, kind of confer an air of concern, for those individuals and a recognition that the economy had failed them. But one thing I've noticed when I've talked to these white men who voted for Trump is that they're pretty willing to criticize him as a president, especially the tweeting, especially the temperament issues, as long as they don't know I'm a journalist, as long as I'm just some girl from Missouri that they meet randomly in some sort of venue and we just start chatting, then they'll just go on, about their disappointments. They find I'm in the media, forget it. So I sometimes wonder, are we getting an accurate representation of what everyone thinks? Because the media where I live is gutted, and I definitely have seen better quality reporting from, say, St. Louis Public Radio, St. Louis Post-Dispatch, about what folks in Missouri are going through, including those who voted for President Trump, than I've seen from, the parachute journalists that come in and out of the region.
What are folks from Missouri going through right now that you think we're not hearing about economically? We're in a city that is basically booming right now.
Yeah,
That's not the case in St. Louis.
St. Louis has been on a downhill slide for several decades, but particularly since the 2008 global economic crash, we've really been hurting. There have been a lot of labor movements trying to do things like raise the minimum wage. They were able to raise that wage to $10 an hour, only to have our now overwhelmingly GOP state legislature strike that wage down and lower it back, to about $7.50. So that's devastating for people. They're going through that. People are losing health care. We have one abortion clinic, the NAACP, labeled Missouri too dangerous for black people to visit because of the overwhelming racism. We have a lot of issues. This is a city, St. Louis, where the Tea Party basically originated, where the Ferguson activism originated. You will see every slice of the political spectrum in one place. And I think we also see things in Missouri before the rest of the country. We used to be the bellwether state. We used to be the state that would kind of predict things on a national level. And since St. Louis's decline, since Missouri's decline, people don't think of us that way. But I think when the country itself is in decline, when people are hurting in the way that they are, that pain was felt first, I think, in places like St. Louis, Missouri, and is only being recognized retrospectively now that the damage is done.
Jonathan, what do you think drives voters politically in the middle of the country? What's the overriding issue for people?
Well, our argument is that what has driven voters generally is our basic differences in what we call worldview, a kind of a personality orientation. Personality is a loaded and complicated term. It doesn't mean it's in our genes, fixed at birth, never to be changed. But people do have, I think, fundamentally different orientations. And as I said, this distinction between an attraction or a comfort with the novel versus the familiar, I think have explained importantly why voters have voted in the direction they have in especially recent decades. And one of the reasons that I think it's worth mentioning in this context is because for all the talk about the white working class, and the white working class certainly delivered their votes overwhelmingly to Donald Trump, there are many white voters who are very well educated who nevertheless also voted for Donald Trump. And the reason we argue, again, not exclusively, but in part they did so, is that they were also attracted, as Ben said before, to a certain style, a certain unwillingness on his part to apologize, a defiance of political correctness. And just to make this point clear, if you are a high school educated white person, who according to these four parenting questions that we talk about, show themselves to be liberal, if you take that person, that high school educated person, and you take somebody with a PhD who nevertheless answers those four parenting questions in a fixed or more conservative direction, it's not their education level, it's how they answer those four questions that's going to tell us the way they voted. And so this is while the education divide is real, it doesn't explain nearly all of why Donald Trump had the support that he did.
Ben, what about the issue of education? I remember you spoke to somebody in your book, you profiled a number of people who had voted for Trump in Lucerne County, Pennsylvania. And one of the people said, I don't have a college education and I'm not ashamed of that at all. And I'm not going to get one. And President Trump is not talking down to me because I don't have that. How does education play into, you know, what you're seeing with people who voted for Trump?
Well, the exit polls showed overwhelmingly that Trump got about 80%, I think it was, among whites who did not go to college. So that's there as a demographic. But what you just alluded to is I think, the most important. It's likability over issues. And people are going to vote in the end, who they're most comfortable with on a gut level rather than this position, that position, or another position on the issues. And Trump voters felt that Hillary condescended to them, and they felt that Trump listened to them. And they say you can fall in love with your therapist because you feel listened to, and voters felt heard by Trump. And he made them feel good about themselves, whereas Hillary made them feel ashamed.
What about the issue of immigration and people that live in some of these places in the middle of the country? What is their experience with immigrants? How do they feel about people coming over both legally and illegally into the country?
Well, I think you're going to get, like with any issue, a very broad spectrum of opinion. And of course, there are, you know, immigrants. St. Louis, for example, has been a refugee city for like 100 years. We have the largest Bosnian population for that reason. But one thing I noticed in 2016 when I was out interviewing people in more rural areas, small towns, where the majority of people were voting for Trump, is that while automation was what had stolen their jobs away, and, you know, these communities really are decimated. You know, the economy is extraordinarily bad, and their concerns are legitimate. They often would pin it on immigration. And so sometimes I would ask, like, well, was there a change in your community? Was there an influx of immigrants? And they're like, well, no, not really. You know, especially Mexico, you know, is a country they bring up a lot. I'm like, well, are there Mexicans in your community? And they're like, oh, you know, there's Jose, he owns the restaurant. I was like, well, is he the problem? Or, oh, no, he's great. It's the rest of them. And so there's just this completely hypothetical invented scapegoat that I think existed as somebody to pin, you know, these broad structural problems on. And of course Trump cultivated this. Of course he tapped into that with this very hateful xenophobic rhetoric that you could go back throughout history, look at the rise of fascist movements, and it almost always starts like this, where you have a community in economic despair, a community that's torn apart by political differences. All these problems are already there waiting to be exploited. And that is what he did. And I do wish that people would look at the economic issues of their community, and I wish that they would do something about automation and the things that are actually stealing people's jobs away, as well as credentialism, which is another problem. That's the heart of people's feelings that they can't get a job, you know, unless they go to college, which costs a ton of money, which they can't afford. We need to do something about that as well. Those are legitimate grievances.
Well, let me just follow up on that for a second, Sarah. Are Democrats doing that right now? You're in a state with a very, very close Senate election between Claire McCaskill and Josh Hawley. Are Democrats connecting on those issues?
Yeah, it depends. I mean, one of the big issues for us, you know, healthcare, jobs, and, you know, the thing with Missouri is that it's like, as I said, you get that whole spectrum, you know, so you're talking to, like, very conservative evangelicals on a farm, and you're talking to, you know, black rights activists in St. Louis or Kansas City, you know, you're going to get that full thing. I'm not sure that it's possible for a politician to convey you know, their inability to connect with everybody, but of people in Missouri like Jason Kander, who ran for senator last time, I think was actually successful. That he's now sadly struggling with PTSD. But yeah, it's a tight race, and I'm not sure, you know, due to all the chaos on a national level, that the state issues are being covered and conveyed as well as they should be.
Jonathan, what about media, the media that people are consuming? How much does what we're producing in Washington and New York, here in Boston and other places in the country that offers national media to people everywhere, how much does that influence the way people think?
Well, I think one of the most significant things about media, and I'm self-conscious about the fact that I'm sitting next to two journalists right now, but a lot of people will say, and I think with reason, that, you know, polarization is not that new. We've had political divisions before. People who remember the 1960s remember riots in the street and assassinations and violence. And I grew up in New York City in the 1970s. It was a far more chaotic place then than it is now. It's like, you know, Disney World in Manhattan. And so there are ways in which clearly things are tamer now, but I think one of the important differences between now and any previous era is both the diversity of media and therefore the ability of people to find the very niche within media that best expresses their own view of the world. And so the Kavanaugh hearings, to me, were a perfect example. I feel like Charlie Brown with the football. I watch Dr. Ford. I think she's compelling and resolute. I admire her. I think Kavanaugh, I guess I'm giving away my personal views here, I think Kavanaugh comes off as unhinged and crazy, and I can't imagine that that's going to be a good approach for him. And lo and behold, half the country found him to be admirable and resolute, and I think media, and now I'm talking in the broadest strokes, plays a critical role in allowing people to find just the outlet that expresses and reinforces how they see the world. And I think that's critical to the division that we're witnessing today.
I was in the studio for 9 hours anchoring NPR's coverage of the Kavanaugh-Blasey Ford hearings, and I asked our political editor, Ron Elving, afterwards, you know, what's your takeaway from what happened? And he said, I think if you were watching her this morning, nobody's watching all the whole thing. If you were watching her this morning, you came away thinking one thing, and if you watched him, you might have come away thinking of something else. If you watched them both, obviously he had enough support to get through. You wanted to say something on that.
Well, I just think you're absolutely right on we live in a era where we have media silos. People just go to the newspaper, the website, the TV station that they want, and they serve as their own editors. There is no one trusted source anymore. And I think that's really worrisome for the country, where we are so polarized now, we can't even agree on what a fact is. Kellyanne Conway has famously come up with a concept of alternative facts. So there are those to consider as well. But we have a president who the Washington Post has written, as of last month, has come up with 5,000 or more false or misleading statements. And when those are pointed out to the Trump base, they dismiss them out of hand as liberal bias. So we can't even agree on what a fact is anymore.
Austin, do you want to weigh in on any of this, what we've been talking about?
Well, it's fascinating. I think one thing that I was thinking of was community and kind of the loss of community and connection between neighbors, particularly in the farm community I'm living in right now. I'm probably the only person under 60 or 70 years old on that road. And young people are leaving. There aren't jobs. The only place to get together with people is the bar. And in some ways, we're so hyper-connected with social media and the internet. But I think in Northwestern Illinois, people feel very lonesome and lonely and disconnected from one another. I always think about the practice of barn raising, where the whole community would come and help raise a barn. Obviously, technology has changed, and there's nothing we can do about that. But something of that spirit, that collective spirit, I think, has been lost a bit. And I think that it really makes people hurt, and it makes them bitter. But I think, as so many of you have pointed out, maybe their bitterness is misdirected.
But they have opportunity. I mean, a lot of these states, Illinois, my home state, your home state of Illinois, is dealing with a big brain drain because young people get educated there, and then they go to the coast because they have a better opportunity.
And I did that myself. I went to the University of Virginia, then I went to Stanford. I kind of followed my writing career wherever it took me, wherever I could get a fellowship, honestly. And it created this kind of guilt in me that I needed to keep speaking for the place. But when I go back now, let's just say I don't dress like this to go to the Scales Mound Tap. I kind of try to fit in. So in a weird way, I feel both part of the place and completely foreign to it, which is an odd situation to be in.
That's the hillbilly elegy phenomenon, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I want to ask each of you a couple of things, and then we'll get to some audience questions. What do you think that people on the coast right now do not understand about the middle of the country that you would like them to understand as we get into this last month before the midterm elections, Ben?
Well, I think they should consider that all Trump voters are not racist. We do live in such a bubble here. And one of the things I hoped my book might do is serve as even a small bridge to get people to understand one another better in this country. You know, when Trump accepted on election night when he won, he did extend an olive branch towards unity, reaching out to the other side. But he's done nothing to follow through on that. And he behaves as president of his base rather than president of the country. And I've never known a politician who doesn't appear interested in expanding his base, but Trump doesn't. He just caters to his base, holds these rallies, and I think is betting that he can get reelected with a strong plurality. You don't need 50% anymore, as Trump and George W. Bush proved, who both lost the popular vote. So I wish someone would, a Democrat maybe, would run on a platform that would try to unify the country more than leave us all in our respective silos.
You think that Trump will be reelected?
I wouldn't bet against him.
And what about the midterms? Do you see a blue wave or a red wave?
I don't know how much of a wave it'll be, but I think the Dems take the House and the Republicans hold the Senate.
Sarah, what do people on the coast need to know about the Midwest?
Well, I think there's been a misperception that, one, the Trump base is bigger than it is, and I distinguish the base from the voters because there are a lot of people who just kind of went, and pulled the lever, as unbelievable as that may sound. I met a lot of folks like that. But there's also, a lot of resistance to Trumpism, and there's no kind of binding factor to that. All sorts of people throughout the Midwest are against the hatred, against the xenophobia, against the con, know, they want accountability. They want representatives to actually, you know, hear them out and do something for their interests. That's almost never covered. You literally get, you know, the New York Times profiling like the same dude in a diner like three times in a year without them even realizing it's the same person. Or you get profiles of what turn out to be GOP operatives, people that once were elected officials or working in the party, posing as your everyday like MAGA wearing, you know, Trump fan. And it's nonsense. If you actually, you know, live in the Midwest, I mean, it depends where you live, you're not going to meet a lot of people like that. There aren't people like out on the street chanting for Trump. There's a lot of disillusionment, a lot of frustration, but, you know, the diversity within the population is great. And also there's a lot of progressive resistance within these states. What we lack is money. We do not have the money that people have on the coast. When I come here, I feel like Katniss coming from District 12 to the Capitol. Like, it's just like, what the hell is this? And so, you know, if you want to help out, go throw some money, like, you know, at a Democrat in a state where people don't have as much to, you know, to donate if you want to see that kind of change happen in the Midwestern states.
Do you think there's a blue wave or a red wave coming?
I'm very concerned about voter suppression, and I've been talking about this somewhat futilely for a couple of years. I think that if there are free and fair elections, the Democrats will do well, and I base this on the extremely high turnout and the result of the special elections that have been held for the last 2 years. But since the partial repeal of the VRA in 2013, we've had new voter ID laws. We've had, you know, recently, within the last month, a lot of new measures passed specifically to disenfranchise the most likely Democratic voters. For example, Native Americans in North Dakota, black voters in Georgia, et cetera. I think that without those measures, the Democrats would do well and would possibly even take both houses, but I don't know. I think, you know, shoot for as much transparency and accountability in these elections as possible, because it's going to be a rough ride no matter what the outcome is.
Jonathan.
First, I just want to second Sarah's annoyance at the Times running that same diner MAGA story. Seems like every other day. But 2 points I want to make. The first is that, and this is actually also to second Sarah, we should not overstate support for Trump. The fact is that he was a deeply unpopular, a historically unpopular candidate. And he's in many ways an historically unpopular president, given that he's presiding over as robust an economy as he is. And so I say that to say that though the temptations to demoralization are great, it's really important to keep that in mind, and to keep in mind that not everybody who voted for Trump loves the guy, and not everybody who voted for Trump in 2016 is committed to voting for him again. The second thing I would say is that we've talked so much about norms over the last couple of years, and one thing we've heard commentators say over and over again is that Trump said or did something that is quote-unquote disqualifying. And I would really like that word to be banned from our political vocabulary, because nothing is disqualifying unless you vote the person out of office. We have, Trump, every once in a while, Trump says something with clarion truthfulness. And one of the things he said with clarion truthfulness was, I could stand in the middle of Fifth Avenue and shoot somebody, and I still wouldn't lose my support. And if he knows that, then we really need to stop talking about disqualifying and breaching. We need to talk about breaching norms because they're important, but not because somehow a norm god is going to defeat Trump for us.
But how did he get to that point where he could stand in the middle of Fifth Avenue and shoot somebody and not lose any support? Millions of Americans knew him only from The Apprentice, which had an enormous audience. I mean, I never watched it, but it had a huge audience, tens of millions of people.
Yes. So I would say that Trump is unique in many ways. But in other ways, he is the product of decades of growing polarization and the drift of the Republican Party in particular in the direction that it has drifted. And it is that history, that foundation that Trump was able to build upon, and the mistrust that Americans feel for one another that allows a candidate to be the way Trump is and still receive the support he does, because the other side... political science term for just a quick moment here. The polarization we have, the partisanship we have, is really negative partisanship. We don't like our own party any more than we did 40 years ago. We hate the other party now. And that hatred for the other party allows somebody like Donald Trump to be competitive when in other circumstances he probably won't.
And just prediction from you for the election?
Because I'm an idiot and I'm still optimistic, I do think Democrats will do very well in the House elections. I agree with Sarah. I'm concerned about vote suppression. The polling on this in state legislative and gubernatorial races is especially hopeful if you're a Democrat. And coming from North Carolina, which was a moderate state till 8 years ago and is now hard right, it's incredibly important to me that Democrats do well at the state level in all the places, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, Michigan, North Carolina, Florida, where they actually have a chance to do well.
Austin, what do people not know on the coast about the Midwest?
Well, I don't mean this to sound as antagonistic as it might sound, but I would just encourage you next time you're in a plane flying over the Midwest, think about the kids standing in a field in Illinois or Iowa looking up and watching you.
What do you mean by that?
I don't know. Just it kind of comes back to my point at the beginning of generalizing a whole region, and I think when you start thinking about the people who are actually living there, then it becomes impossible to do so.
What do you remember about growing up in the Midwest? I remember reading an article about Grant Achatz, who's a very famous chef in Chicago, and one of his dishes involves burning leaves on the table to give the smell that he used to smell in Michigan in the summertime.
That's amazing.
I'm just wondering if there's anything like that for you.
Anything like that sensory? Well, it's funny. I was offered milk yesterday, and I had to turn it down because my entire family doesn't drink milk, having grown up on a dairy farm and you're around it so much. Yeah, I take it in my coffee, and that's about it.
But you say milk, not milk, which they do say in Illinois.
And my dad says milk, and I think living in California, unfortunately, my accent's changed a bit.
Okay, and I'm just going to give you the opportunity, as all of these people have, to give us a prediction for what happens in November.
As a poet, I'm going to plead the Fifth Amendment and political predictions and defer to
okay. my co-pilots. All right, we have a microphone right up here. If anybody wants to come up and ask a question, we've got some time for that, and we've got a few people that are moving, so maybe they're on their way. Here we go. Oh, look at that.
Okay. couple words that no one has mentioned, and I'm very curious what you think the impact will be, the Mueller investigation, the possibility for fake news, and I've even heard crazy talk like civil war and all kinds of nuttiness. So I'd just be interested to hear what your take is.
Well, the Mueller investigation is probably the $64,000 question. I think that's the only thing right now that I see that could really, I mean, of course, the 2020 is 2 years off, but right now, for example, my little microcosm of Luzerne County, of the 12 people that I profiled in depth, 11 of them say that if the election were held tomorrow, they'd be with Trump. Only one has slipped into the undecided category. A few said that that their minds could be changed if Mueller delivers a smoking gun. So I think that's everyone is waiting for to see what he comes up with.
I have a comment on that. That's okay. Mm-hmm. The Mueller investigation is more of a criminal inquiry than I think it is an electoral issue. And my concern about that is that Mueller has been engaged in a race against time, a race against autocratic consolidation. And what I worry about that investigation is that the results of it will be released, be incredibly damning. Trump will pardon everybody. We will have a packed Supreme Court, packed lower courts, packed state courts. And, you know, this basically, it's a crime syndicate posing as a government, will be able to stay in power. And so that's something we should be thinking about just as citizens, no matter where we live, about how we're going to react to that kind of blatant criminality and lack of accountability and kleptocratic con job taking us all down. If something's going to unify us, maybe it's that.
Thank you for this discussion. I work in downtown Boston, and I can vouch for the fact that there are very passionate Trump supporters, well-educated, right here in amongst us. And with walk into someone's office, and there's a MAGA hat sitting right up on top of the file cabinet. So anyway, my question is for Mr. Wyler. I was really struck by this concept, and I have not read your book, but of these sort of two different personalities, for lack of a better word, of fluid versus
fixed.
Yes. Thank you. And I'm curious about what effect this might have on the sort of blindness that we see in terms of the blindness to the myriad examples of corruption and kleptocratic tendencies that we're seeing in this administration, not just from Trump himself, but from all of these cabinet members. I mean, it seems to me so evident, and Trump supporters seem to just turn a blind eye to it. And is that somehow related to the theory that you're talking about?
Well, I think it is for a couple of reasons. One is that, one of the things we say is that what's distinctive about polarization nowadays is the degree to which our non-political Americans in general are actually not that interested in politics. And that's certainly been true historically. What's distinctive about today is the degree to which our non-political preferences, which we do care a lot about, align with our political preferences in a way that reinforce the idea that folks on the other side aren't just people we disagree with on the issues, but that we just see as alien and unrecognizable to us. And it makes it easier for us to impute bad faith to the other side. So there was a Gallup poll in January that asked people, that found that 40% of Republicans said that even accurate information about politicians they supported that was nevertheless disparaging, they regarded as fake news. And my interpretation of that is that if you see somebody running down someone you support, you are just going to assume that they are acting in bad faith. And in a way, the notion of fake news is a way of signaling that you do not buy the integrity of the source that's making the claim. So it's not even a question of evaluating the factualness of a particular issue. It's whether you trust the source. And with mistrustfulness as high as it is now, I think it's easier to see how notions like fake news get the traction that they do.
Yes, sir.
There have been a number of articles of late about electronic voting and its vulnerability to hacking in various forms. I had originally thought of the question addressing Mr. Bradley and the county, whether perhaps that was an example, as occurred in Georgia, where there were 267 voters, but the primary showed that 680 had voted, all electronically with no paper record. My question is, do you think this is going to be an issue that will impact us in these midterm elections? Thank you.
Well, I'm not aware of any hacking that happened in my county. I do think, obviously, the Russian hack, the overarching issue remains, and it's something that we need to be concerned about. There's some talk about going back to paper ballots as a more reliable system.
Or at least having a paper backup for every electronic vote.
Yeah.
This is mostly for Sarah Kendzior. I wanted to thank you for your clear-sighted editorials. They've been an enormous balm in these times. Thank you so much for all your work you do. I know that you've studied dictatorships, specifically Uzbekistan. Is there anything that this discussion hasn't touched on regarding dictatorships and the consolidation of authoritarian power that you would like to highlight?
God, that's a big question. Yeah, for those who don't know, I have a PhD in anthropology, and I spent it studying authoritarian states in the former Soviet Union. So I'm just very 2018 here on the Midwest panel and the authoritarian panel. But yeah, I guess one thing I would like to say about that is there's this myth of it can't happen here when you think about authoritarianism in the United States. And I would like to say that yes, it can happen here, but also it has happened here. We have had legal sanctioned authoritarian initiatives that are just as bad as things I witnessed in the former Soviet Union. Slavery, internment camps, the genocide of Native Americans. And we have an administration now, particularly people like Stephen Miller and their policy toward immigrants and migrants on the border, that are just as disgusting and brutal and horrifying as anything I've seen in an authoritarian state. And we're also seeing, you know, as people have been pointing out, a lack of accountability, widespread corruption. So yes, the distance between the Midwest and Central Asia is not that vast. And I think it is important for us to look at parallels between, our country and other countries, both the sort of move to the right that you see in Poland and Hungary and Turkey and other former democracies, as well as historically in our own country, particularly to the most vulnerable people, which is generally non-white Americans.
Yes.
Hi. I am from Southern Ohio. I'm also gay and Jewish in an area where it's very unsafe to be so. And I'm a student here in Boston, but I'm going to be going home for the holidays. I was wondering if any of you had any advice for someone going back into a community that they had a feeling that was unsafe for them before, but now know is unsafe.
Can I just ask you a follow-up question? Why do you feel unsafe there?
There has always been, when you're a child and you're steeped in a society that has a barely concealed hatred of everything that you are, it becomes obvious in the smallest of ways, in the ways that kids interact with you when you're in first, second grade, when people view you as an outlier, like when kids throw pennies at your feet or ask if you have horns or ask if you eat babies. It's people who don't have any background in what you're sort of doing and how you are as a human being. But
do you feel that things have gotten worse for you under this administration?
I feel like things have become, they've always been underneath, now they're coming to the surface. Because you can kind of bury your head in the sand. These are people that I love and people who I grew up with and my mother's parents and my mother's family. And it's just not, I just was wondering if.
So yeah. let me, I don't know if you're going to get any advice from this.
No, I know. Let me
just throw this question out there, which is if you're in a small town in the Midwest, you don't have the kind of diversity that you have in a place like Boston or in other major cities, even St. Louis. I mean, St. Louis is a big city that you've got a lot of people there, a lot of different backgrounds. You have, gays and lesbians and Jews and other groups. Are there places right now in 2018 America where you don't have that still and somebody, can feel very out of place in their own home?
Well, I wouldn't presume to give the young lady any advice, but I would say that she alluded to things have gotten worse. And I think one thing that Trump has done is give people license to say and do things that were previously considered taboo. Mm-hmm. And I think his supporters, they would couch it in terms of, society is so politically correct, and Trump is politically incorrect. Mm-hmm. And these have become tropes, but they really liked how he would dare and say things that then enabled them to follow suit. I profile one of the people in my book is a what's euphemistically called these days a white nationalist, really a white supremacist, former Ku Klux Klan guy who got himself elected to the local Republican County Committee And that illustrates the extent to which extremism has become the norm.
I think there's a... Yeah, go ahead, John.
I just want to add quickly to what Ben said, which is that for decades, social scientists have been studying this notion of implicit bias and arguing that coded racial appeals work best because they're not overt, and therefore you have some cover. And Trump came along and really just blew that out of the water. And it's been, I think, in many ways the most troubling development of the last couple of years, that George Allen Jr., a Virginia senator, Republican, had a very promising political career that was derailed in large measure because he used a term macaca, which was a racial slur that almost nobody was familiar with until it was explained. Now, I think many Republicans would wear that as an absolute badge of honor.
Well, Trump has used the term animal to describe immigrants, and there have been a number
Mexican
of
immigrants
these terms.
Are rapists.
Exactly, right. Rapists, right.
Yeah.
Yes, go ahead, Sarah, yeah.
Because you came looking for advice. I don't know what to give for advice because I don't know your particular story, but I just want to give some encouragement that, you know, if you have a hard time and you feel that you're alone in this, there are so many people who are fighting to preserve your rights, fighting, you know, to preserve your dignity, and, you know, we're not letting up. People aren't going to, you know, just back off of this, and it doesn't matter what this administration does. People are going to fight for you.
I can see Austin's watch from here, so I see that we have about 5 minutes. So I'm going to take two more questions, and then we're going to finish off with a poem.
First off, I just want to say thank you for your comments about the Midwest. I'm from Kansas City, and living in Boston, you hear a lot about flyover country, and it gets frustrating. But also, you guys mentioned about how people in the Midwest felt seen by Trump and his, they felt like Hillary was condescending and Trump really, like, saw them for who they were. So, like, what advice do you think Democrats could take to really connect with people in the Midwest, but in a way that doesn't revert to, like, xenophobic, hateful comments and still make them feel seen and connected and, like, possibly vote for a Democrat?
I think Democrats need to learn to listen better, and that there might be money for them in running on a more of a unity platform. How do we come together as a country? Even the Trump people say that they wish they could, both sides weren't so dug in, but no one knows how to start a dialogue. And Trump's certainly not going to do that because he sees no percentage in it. But I think listening is the key. And if the Democrats nominate Elizabeth Warren, Kamala Harris, or others, Cory Booker, I fear they're going to go down big.
Why?
Because it's a center-right country, and those people won't fly.
Why not? I mean, what is it about Kamala Harris and Cory Booker, also Elizabeth Warren?
I'm just giving you my gut. I'm just giving you my gut, and I'm from here, and I like Elizabeth Warren, but it's a conservative country, and I just don't see them resonating.
One more question.
I'll change the direction a little bit. My question is for Austin. My brush with the Midwest came studying agricultural economics at K-State, kind of with a focus on food security. And one of the things that I've been following is the aging of America's farmers. And so I wondered if, like, your personal story was a little bit about coming back to see the farm prosper. And do you have any thoughts from your own experience or the experience of your community on positive trends that might reverse this crisis we're facing, as some 65% of America's farms will turn over in the next maybe 20 years?
Thank you. Excellent question. Well, very briefly, because I know we're almost out of time, my grandfather sent 7 kids to college milking about 15 cows. And my dad milked cows for 30 years, and we sold the farm in 2008, and it was really kind of impossible for him to carry it on at that point. So, and that, 50 years' time, it became extremely difficult. Obviously, organic agriculture and that the return to organic farming in the Midwest is really encouraging. The work Wendell Berry has done is incredible. So I think that there's hope for a turnaround in that vein.
Okay. Thanks to all of you. Let's wrap up with Austin with a poem or two.
Okay. So I was going to read a poem about Trump, but you know what? Let's move on. Let's do two short poems. This one is called The Capacity of Speech. It is easy to be decent to speechless things, to hang houses for the purple martins to nest in, to bed down the horses under the great white wing of the year's first snow, to ensure the dog and cat are comfortable, to set out suet for the backyard birds, to put the poorly shot wounded deer down, to nurse its orphaned fawn until its spots are gone, to sweep the spider into the glass and tap it out into the grass, to blow out the candle and save the moth from flame, to trap the black bear and set it free, to throw the thrashing brook trout back. How easy it is to be decent to things that lack the capacity of speech, to feed and shelter whatever will never beg us or thank us or make us ashamed. And then just a celebratory poem to go off on a lighter note. This is called Ode to Flower. I was feeling down and wanted to praise something harmless, something we don't necessarily need, but that I'm glad we have, and I lit just now upon flour. I suppose flour could be harmful if you don't eat wheat, but let's assume you do. Think, where did your mother keep the flour when you were a child? Or your father? Perhaps it was your father who did the baking. Maybe neither your mother nor your father baked, but they still kept some flour around, left over from Christmas, or because a neighbor had brought some over. Though why a neighbor would bring flour over and then leave without it, I don't know. Anyway, you can tell I want there to have been flour in your childhood kitchen, in a paper bag that gave off a little gasp of powder every time it was opened, which wasn't often. On the side of the bag, a girl in a dress tiptoed amongst hens, a wicker basket on her arm, and it was understood she was bringing bread to the sick and poor. Or maybe your family stored the flour in a glass jar with a wire lid that latched, or in a stoneware canister with the word flour painted in blue cursive on the side. Wherever it was, maybe you reached your hand inside every now and then to wonder at how something so dry could feel so cool that it felt damp. Or maybe this is the wrong poem for you. Maybe you loved salt.
Okay, thanks all for coming, and they'll be heading right back there to sign some books.